Hi, I'm Barbara Bogave, and this is your Marketplace Money podcast for the weekend of April 19th, 2013.
I'll polish the leaves, make them green again, shake out the trees, change scene again, spring cleaning, getting ready for love.
So nice to have you with us, as always. Coming up this hour, we're talking about spring cleaning our financial lives. But first, let's take care of some housekeeping of our own here at Marketplace Money. Over the last several months, we've been tweaking the show, and we've asked for your feedback. You've really stepped up. Thank you so much for that. One of the recurring themes we're noticing, you want to hear more of each other on the show. That means more of your questions and your money dilemmas, and of course, more callers. That sounds good to us, too. But we need your help. If we're to have more of you on the show, we do need to hear from you. You can call us up. You can get... Oh, my gosh. I'm so sorry. I can't believe this. Hold, I got to get this. It's my daughter. Hello, Molly. Oh, honey, I know. I just asked people to call, but I didn't mean you.
Thanks, though. Yes. Yeah. Love you, too.
Sorry about that. Anyway, you can reach us on our Facebook page. You can also get in touch on Twitter. And you can always write to us, of course, at marketplacemoney.org. We can't wait to hear from you. Well, now we've got that out of the way, let's get to our personal finance spring cleaning spectacular. And the good news, the first step is already behind you. You filed your taxes, and you likely learned what needs tweaking.
I learned, actually, that I didn't make as much money this year as I thought I did. Also, I moved from New York to L.A., so I also learned there's a lot of differences between different deductions you can get on a state-by-state basis. I think I actually lost some deductions that I would have made because I moved in the middle of the year.
I noticed that we couldn't claim nothing out of an itemized list. We couldn't claim a lot of stuff that we could have because we tend to spend more things of what we want, not what we need. Go out to the movies a lot, going out to the bars and things like that we could cut down on.
I've been married for 2 years, and this is the first year we actually had to pay taxes, and it's really unclear to me why this year. It's like, we have to pay. That's probably because we made more money this past year. But then when you talk to other people, contemporaries, friends, and everyone's talking about getting money back, and you look and you're like, well, they seem all to be in the same bracket as us. That's when I feel confused.
It is very difficult as a small business owner to not be able to get, you know, some of the benefits that these larger corporations get, which are massive deductions and subsidies. It's like, ugh, you know, we're dying here as little people.
My tax experience this year was very positive. I used TurboTax, and then within a week to 10 days, I got my return back electronically. And, I just need to be more diligent in saving, you know, receipts and things. And I didn't do many write-offs this year, and I guess I probably missed some opportunities to save some money. But I'll get on that next year.
And you just heard Megan Ortiz and Jose Chaure in Los Angeles, also Zach Pleasant and Marcus Waters in Washington, D.C., and Rebecca Lankish in New York City, all reflecting back on what their tax returns have taught them. Of course, they can reflect back because they made the deadline. But what if you missed the deadline to file or to request an extension? Or what if you messed up your taxes in more catastrophic ways? Who do you turn to then?
My name is Kelly Phillips Serb, and I am a tax attorney, and I practice in southeastern Pennsylvania. My job is to fix people's problems, fix people's tax problems. I fix returns that either weren't filed exactly the way they should have been or weren't filed exactly the way that IRS thinks they should have been. I help taxpayers tell their story and explain to IRS, here's why the mistake happened, and here's what we propose to do to fix it. So I do a lot of talking off of ledges. One of the things that I think is fun about my job is that I'm not just a tax attorney. I joke that I fix marriages. I had this great couple one time that I represented, and the taxpayer actually kept two sets of books. And I know everybody always reads about that and thinks it never happens. But this guy actually had two sets of books. He had two ledgers, and they were the old green ledgers, you know, with the long paper. And he had the money that he actually received in his cash-based business. And then he had a list that he reported to IRS. And his wife kept the one set of books and was completely in the dark about the other set of books. And of course, he got audited and he called me up one day and he said, I need you after all because my wife is making me. And we negotiated a settlement, and it actually ended up going really well for the taxpayer, and all was resolved. And I got the loveliest thank you from his wife, who basically said, you know, now I don't have to kill him. And that kind of thing actually happens a lot in my practice because, again, sometimes it's the fear of the unknown, like what's going to happen. And you fight a lot because you're scared about what tomorrow might bring with the IRS. And so in this instance, it was just really terrific because, you know, not only did taxpayer save his business, he saved his marriage.
Tax attorney Kelly Phillips Erb, otherwise known as the Tax Girl, lives and works in Philadelphia, Pennsylvania. All right, with taxes behind us, let the fiscal spring cleaning and rug thumping continue. For me, that means opening up a 529 college savings plan for my daughter. Yep, the one who just called at the top of the show. What about you?
I think spring cleaning is both a physical and kind of metaphorical thing, where some people like to think of the new year as being a time when you really think about it. I think when the weather starts getting nice, you want to clean out your apartment, you want to think about things you want to do this summer, when its ability to be much more active and things like that. So what do we really want to do this summer? Where do we want to travel? Like, what kind of activities? What are things in D.C. have we not done yet? That's the kind of thing in terms of when I think of spring cleaning, I think of it's almost like turning over a bit of a new leaf as well as cleaning out the old stuff.
I think I want to be more frugal in areas that aren't as important to me and have more money to buy really good produce, not going out to restaurants, you know, and, you know, really evaluating, do I really need to buy any new clothes, even though I did lose weight, things don't fit me quite as well, but it's like, do I really care, you know? So just trying to make priorities and be a grown-up. I'm 53 now, so I figure it's about time.
Well, I really don't do spring cleaning. I clean all the time. I clean all the time. You know, I have a household of six, so I clean all the time.
That's Marcia Anderson in Washington, D.C., along with Zach Pleasant and Diane Ligon in New York City. If only we were all like Marcia, right, and cleaning up our finances all the time. But when you do finally get around to it, one of the first things you need to do is take a hard look at your savings and investments. And that can be traumatic. So we've invited Dr. Richard Peterson to join us. He's a psychiatrist and investment advisor with the firm Market Psych. He has some advice on how to revamp your portfolio. Welcome, Richard.
Thank you.
So many of our experts who come on this show tell us that we should rebalance our portfolios more than once a year. But let's say you're like me and you've let it go for a while. Where should you start?
The funny thing about tax season is it gives us that chance to go over the past year and to see where the leakage was in our portfolio and our finances and where things are going well, where they're not going well.
Okay, assuming you have it all laid out before you on the floor on your computer, what are the basics that everyone should reevaluate? And I'm assuming you're going to start with, say, an emergency fund.
There's the ideal world of what we do with our saving, and then there's the reality. And I think most people live in reality. So while we say we should save, say, 12% of our income and put that away in an emergency fund, the reality is most people are struggling to pay off credit card debt. So there's the reality of, should you maximize your 401k and at the same time be paying interest on your credit cards? And of course not. You know, we should pay off that credit card. And there are different ways of looking at this. And in my opinion, it's got to start little step by little step. If you're running behind on saving money, the only way to catch up is to take one controllable small action. Increase your saving by 1% this month, something along those lines. The reality, though, is it's just like dieting, just like New Year's resolutions. We start out on a big grand plan. This year, I will save 12% every month. And then at the end of the month, we think, oh, no, this isn't going to work. And we shoot it all, and we're just on our credit card debt again.
Given that this is going to be different depending on where you are in life in terms of age and marital status and employment history and all that, what are the red flags? How do you prioritize cleaning up the portfolio?
there's sort of two conversations. There's, do we have savings and are able to manage it in a portfolio? And then there's, as I mentioned, credit card debt, for example. So let's assume that you've got your portfolio and you've got investments, for example, and you've got a 401k and maybe some mutual funds for your work. And I think a lot of people see red flags as decline in value, when in fact, that's not a red flag. Real investments that have real risk are often the ones that tend to perform best over time. The red flags are when you make investment choices based on your enthusiasm or your excitement about something. Enthusiasm and excitement or the obviousness of an investment, those are always bad signs. The markets are paradoxical. They tend to be contrarian. The best investments are not those that hit you in the face and they say, put your money here. They're the ones that say, that don't say anything and are hiding in the corner and they look kind of depressing. That's usually the best investment. So if you can find those, that's really what you need to be looking for.
Well, while we're talking about emotions and money, how do you deal with an investment that you're psychologically attached to? So you don't really have that objectivity to reassess it.
Wow. Well, psychological attachment to an investment, gosh, it's so common. The way that you can break free of the attachment to an investment is to start looking at the investment analytically in terms of the numbers behind it. The P/E ratio is X. The management has been in place for 5 years. The margins on their products are declining and are only 5%. Looking at the numbers is what will allow you to break free of that. When you look at the other characteristics like, oh, I love that product they make. Man, that tablet is so exciting. Oh, it's so beautiful. When you look at it emotionally, then you build that attachment. So you have to try to detach.
You know, my tendency is always to simplify everything, consolidate my accounts and that kind of behavior in the spring. Is that a good way to think about this kind of fiscal cleaning?
I think for most people, and probably you as well, when we're doing taxes and we're focusing on those details, it's a little bit stressful. And the funny thing about stress is it makes us more detail-oriented. When we're feeling a little bit down or a little bit pessimistic, the way our brains change, in fact, literally, we release chemical stress hormones that cause our attention to become more focused and more focused on details. We become very good at that. So when we're doing taxes and we're complaining about the government taking such a big share and, oh my gosh, I can't believe I couldn't save enough, that kind of negativity actually makes our minds clearer about exactly what's happening. It makes us easier to focus on the details. So in terms of tax season being a good time to lay out long-term plans, it generally is because we're more realistic. We have to deal with the real numbers and we're able to focus on those details at like no other time.
Dr. Richard Peterson is a psychiatrist and investment advisor with the firm Market Psych. Great to talk with you. Thank you.
Thanks. Take care.
Every week, it seems some of you folks ask us for advice about how to talk to friends and family members about money problems. So we figured while we're doing our seasonal personal finance housekeeping, why not help you tidy up the loose ends in some of these very difficult situations? We've pulled in consumer finance expert Dayana Yoakum of The Motley Fool to lend a hand. Dayana, nice to have you with us.
Hi, Barbara.
It is such a cold-hearted concept to spring clean our relationships, isn't it? Could you make the case for why we should do this, though? Because I think most of us would just walk 100 miles out of our way to avoid even thinking about money issues and our friends.
Well, right. Talking about money, it has become like the conversational third rail. But you absolutely have to face these issues head on. But we're talking about money dust bunnies with friends, or if you're in a relationship, mapping out a plan with your spouse so that you are both on the same page about here's how we're going to direct our dollars in the near term. And we both agreed we're going to direct our money towards these goals in the long term. And therefore, we're going to be thinking about this, bringing consciousness to our spending at every moment. I suggest, you know, sitting down and having your financial summit together quarterly works for companies. That way you can see, are we on track? Because you don't want to be surprised after a year or 2 years to say, wow, we really haven't saved enough for a down payment on a house, or we really aren't going to be able to send Junior to an out-of-state college.
Okay, forget about spring cleaning. Quarterly cleaning, order in the Danish like a corporation.
That's right, Danish and some lukewarm coffee.
Well, great. With that in mind, let's turn to our callers now.
First up, we have a listener right here in Los Angeles, Viviano, and he posted on our Marketplace Money Facebook page. And by the way, that is a great way to keep in touch with us and maybe get on the show to ask your question. So Viviano, hi, you're on the air.
Hi, how are you?
Oh, just great. Welcome to Marketplace Money. Now, I see from your Facebook post that you're financing your fiancé's college education. Generous guy. Tell us more. Tell us about your setup. Are you guys living together?
We are. I'm a 30-plus-year-old guy, we'll say. And while I have a pretty decent job taking care of my two kids, and at the same time, although she's not a kid, helping my fiancé get through school and, of course, daily life, because she doesn't have a job, does take a toll and does make me sacrifice a little bit. And so that's really why I posted to the page to answer the question about who in my life is also affecting my paycheck, and she definitely is. I don't have to pay for everything, thankfully, but because I do make enough money, she can't get all of the payments that she would, you know, that other people can get, I guess. She goes to Cal Poly now, and she transferred from a community college a couple of years back and is majoring in physics.
So that, I'm guessing, I don't want to pin you down, but I'm guessing that's a, you know, couple thousand, $3,000 to $5,000 that you're...
It is per quarter, because they're on the quarter system. It can range from summer quarters from a $1,500, which is not a lot, but in one shot it can be, up to fall and other quarters, which cost double, triple that amount.
And how are you doing? What do you do for a living? And how much of a hit does that feel like to you?
While I said, like I said, I do have a good job, it's definitely not unlimited. I'm a biomedical engineer at a hospital, and so I work on medical equipment. And my paychecks will be about that amount in total every 2 weeks. So when I have a $1,500, $3,000 amount, it can very quickly drain the reserves, if not completely, depending on, you know, her workload and, you know, if my kids want to go to mad scientist camp or whatever else they want to do.
Well, you have, yeah, there are two kids. That's quite a lot to carry.
It is. On one paycheck, it is, yes.
Huh. And just one more question before I'm gonna let Diana loose on you. What is your fiancé's long-term career goal, and when can you expect her to contribute financially to your family?
That's a great question. depending on, you know, what you guys know about physics or physicists,
which is very little.
Yeah, generally they like to think all day, and jobs really don't come into the picture. She definitely wants to be a cosmologist to study the stars, and astrophysicist to, you know, map the heavens, I guess. And she doesn't plan, because she's still going to be finishing her PhD and other things for years to come. We're looking at 3 to 4 years before she can start in the field and start bringing in a paycheck.
Well, Diana Viviano, he's all yours.
Wow. Yeah. No, this is Hi. This is a really interesting situation, because if someone were asking me what to do about their kid that's in college and appears to be on their way to becoming a permanent student, I'd say, all right, eventually you're going to have to cut him off, right? But that said, she's not your child. She's your partner.
Yes.
She's your partner in life and money. And while you happen to be the breadwinner right now, you are both still, you're co-CEOs of your family finances.
I agree.
As co-CEOs, you've got to come up with a plan together, or else this festers and goes on for a long time. And in fact, you could potentially be digging yourself into a financial hole.
Viviano, have you started to have this conversation with your fiancé?
Oh, definitely, especially when we get down to the bare bones, we tend to have the conversation more often.
Well, yeah, I am thrilled to hear that you are having this conversation. It's a difficult thing to do. And so if you've decided, yes, the sacrifice is worth it, both of you have, tuition payments should not come as a surprise. They're on the calendar. You should be planning for how much the bill is going to be, when it's going to come, and be setting aside money, if you can, to satisfy that debt. And I understand money's tight, so this might mean that she makes sacrifices as well. Is it possible that she could work part-time or over the holidays to bring in some extra money to be able to give you guys a little bit of a cushion and get you ahead of the curve here?
Diana and Viviana, can we, like, get down to the bare bones and get real here? Is this a sustainable financial model for you as a family?
Do you have emergency savings? What if something were to happen and you weren't earning an income for a while? Could you manage?
It is absolutely not sustainable. So we kind of peck and grind as we go along, get lucky here and there. Tax return season comes around, things like that that really help boost us. But I just think I've done a poor job of planning for those things that you mentioned. The, you know, it's on the calendar, I should know.
Yeah, and these, you know, what you're going to look at is essentially your balance sheet. How much do you have coming in, and what are your must-pay expenses? What are the nice-to-haves, and what are the really do I need, yeah, 1 billion gigabyte speed on our internet connection or all of those cable channels? So that is the reality check that everybody has to do. And first and foremost, you are a family unit right now, and you've just got to – you're going to have to adjust the plan. Maybe it's that she takes a lighter class load and you're extending the amount of time that it takes for her to get her degree. So – look at the parts of the plan that can be adjusted.
Viviana, when are you getting married?
Oh, that's a great question as well. We are actually planning, we were planning on doing that when she graduated. So this will very much
the world's longest engagement.
That's correct.
That's okay.
I wish you good luck, and I hope that set you on a good course.
Awesome. I appreciate it. Thank you very much.
Oh, and thanks for calling in and also checking in with us on Facebook. And I hope you write in again and tell us what happens, okay?
Definitely will. Thank you.
Take care.
Bye.
Well, romantic relationships aren't the only ones affected by money. We have another Facebook friend who wrote us about just a heartbreaking money problem, actually, she's facing with her siblings. Mary Beth is on the line from Atlanta. Hi, Mary Beth.
Hi.
Welcome to the show. So tell us about your brother.
Well, my brother, who is in his mid-40s, was diagnosed with a rare fatal disease about 7 or 8 years ago, given 1 or 2 years to live, and is still with us, which is wonderful on almost every level. The only problem is he's kind of gone through all of his money. He can no longer work. 3 years ago, he had his last surgery, and the doctor said definitely no more than 6 months. He could make it 8 months if it's a miracle. And so he's still with us. And so he doesn't have any more money. He is trying to stay in his own house, which I want to support very much. But my sister and I, his twin sister and I, are supporting him now. And I sent him a budget a few months ago, and he filled it out and told me what he needed. And I didn't, you know, make him show it to me. And now I'm kind of torn between judging every single purchase and feeling like I have the, you know, sort of a right to judge, in a sense, basis, you know, versus being too controlling. And this is with somebody who I really love and who's an adult.
First of all, I am so sorry.
Thank you.
And, okay, and can you afford to do what you're doing?
We can. Well, for now, we can. I've been trying to get a HELOC, second mortgage, just to help with these expenses because I don't really have the cash flow. So I'm doing it from savings.
This is a home equity loan, of course.
Right, a home equity line of credit. And I think I'm going to get it. I've gotten the heads up, but I don't know how long that's going to last. It's not going to be a huge amount.
Sure. Now, when you say you want more control, is that because you just want to know what his financial situation really is, or is there some issue with how he spends money and how he handles his finances?
Probably both. I mean, he's not a particularly fiscally responsible person, and he certainly has been known to do some gambling. I don't think like addiction-type gambling, but like betting on sports games and things, and possibly some recreational drug use, and I just don't know. And so I feel like if I paid his utilities and took care of all of those things, he doesn't have a house payment, then I could say, okay, here's a couple $100 for food and fun, and that, you know, would be enough for a normal person. And right now I don't know how much he needs for his gas and his water and all of that.
But just to give us a context, can I ask you how much are we really talking a month? What are you laying out?
Currently, my sister and I are each sending him $800 a month. I send money on the first and she sends it in the middle of the month.
So difficult. Diana, what do you think?
Of course, you toss it over to me, right? Yeah,
well, I wanted Diana. I thought that what Diana said to the previous caller was so good that maybe she could have this difficult conversation with my brother for me, and she could ask him to make that list about the nice to have, need to have, and all
yeah.
of that.
Well, first of all, I have to say you are an awesome sister.
Yes, I agree.
That is just amazing. And I'm sure he appreciates it. And he must understand that this money is not coming out of thin air. And so you've got to let him know that. And that in order for you to help him out, you need to do some planning on your end. And that opens the door to having this practical conversation. So we need to just get down to the nitty gritty of managing his expectations and also your abilities, because you are dipping into money that was intended to support you in the future.
Correct.
And pulling money out of your house or retirement accounts, you know, we like to say that should be the last way that you get extra money. But I understand you're dealing with extraordinary circumstances. So tell him, I am happy to continue to help. What I need to do is figure out exactly how much I can afford to do it and what we're talking about. And so you have a right to push a little bit. You are supporting him. You and your sister are supporting him. I understand. And have you discussed what happens to the home when he's no longer living there?
Yes. He has a couple of children, and we will pay. My sister and I plan to pay ourselves back whatever we have spent. The question that we're struggling with now is what happens when we've gone beyond that and we're paying him money out of our pocket that we won't get back, that there's no expectation of getting back. How far will we go down that road? So we're trying to limit the monthly outlay at this point so that doesn't happen. Our goal would be for that to never happen.
Right, right. The other thing is broaching the subject of taking on the bill payments. Maybe it's a matter of saying, you know, I'd like to clear your plate of this.
That's how I plan to do it. You know, I think we can do this on set it so that it's automatic and you don't have to worry about making these payments. So if you do get sick and things, these will be taken care of. And that is sort of how I was hoping to approach it, as a let me do you this favor here.
Yeah, I think that's exactly right.
Mary Beth, I know that you're a divorce attorney also, and I'm curious, have you applied any of your experiences dealing with couples and their money to your situation with your brother and your sister? Does it transfer?
Absolutely. And when you were talking about managing expectations, that's a word we use constantly. I do a lot of collaborative divorce, and we are always talking about managing clients' expectations and having difficult conversations. And we go to seminars on difficult conversations. And I feel like I teach other people how to do this all day long and say it's going to be difficult, and this is how you're going to do it, and this is how you want to phrase it. But it's so much more difficult when it's your own flesh and blood and you've got to have that conversation.
So easy to say. So
much easier to advise other people than it is to do it.
I wish you the best with this very difficult situation. And thanks so much for sharing it with us today.
Thank you so much for your help.
And thank you, Diana. It's been such a pleasure to have you on the show, too.
Thank you. It's really great to talk to people about this topic, because everybody wants to avoid it. You shouldn't. And it's not as bad to have these conversations as you think it's going to be.
Diana Yoakum is a consumer finance expert with Motley Fool. And thanks again.
Thank you, Barbara. It was my pleasure.
This is Marketplace Money from APM. Well, not only is it hard to talk to your family members about money, it can be nearly impossible to look dispassionately at your finances when your feelings are running so high. But that's what you have to do when you're making one of the biggest life decisions of all. And I'm talking about whether to extricate yourself from your marriage. It's something that older couples are doing more often now. With the kids grown up and the nest empty, senior parents are opting to divorce. But commentator Lori Eber says they should think twice before signing the papers.
The boomer uncoupling trend has become so common it even has a name, gray divorce. I'm happily married, but some of my friends who've been married for over 30 years have suddenly decided to call the whole thing off. It puzzles me why so many 60s flower children are ditching all the wedded peace and love in their later years. A word of caution is in order. Before you decide the grass will be greener as a single, consider the financial impact of divorce. In general, a divorced boomer is significantly poorer than a married one. Experts estimate that it costs at least 30% more to live as a carefree single than as a couple. That's because you'll likely need your own bachelor pad, a standalone medical policy, and perhaps even a new car. Vacations and eating out will suddenly be more expensive without a partner to share the costs. Once you finish splitting up the pots and pans, some of the other financial downsides set in. Your 401ks are likely to be split in two, so you may have to defer your retirement plans. And when you go solo, you'll likely pay higher taxes and miss some cherished tax breaks you've become accustomed to, like the mortgage deduction. And there's more. If you spent your adult life being a great mom, the credit bureaus may find you invisible. Worse yet, maybe your spouse has been secretly racking up credit card debt for which you will now be held jointly responsible. So before you decide to untie the well-worn knot, take a long, hard look at the lifestyle changes in store for you. You may just decide to love the one you're with.
Lori Eber writes about aging and elder care at agingbeatsthealternative.com. Earlier in the show, we heard about spring cleaning our investment portfolio. And that's certainly important, provided you are lucky enough to have an investment portfolio. All of us, however, have expenses, and spring is the perfect time to get realistic about budgeting. Carmen Wong Ulrich is here now to help us set some limits. Carmen is a personal finance journalist and the author of The Real Cost of Living, and it is so nice to have you back.
Thanks for having me.
Okay, Carmen, I've got my hair up in a kerchief, I've got my rubber gloves on, and we're just going to sweep up our spending habits. And so while I think up more ridiculous ways to extend this metaphor, maybe you could tell us why it's a good time to do this right now after we've finished filing our taxes.
You know, if you've been listening to me over the years, you wouldn't even have a refund right now, so you wouldn't have any extra money. But it is a good time, however, since you are deep in your finances and have been, that you've been digging in there, and you've probably had some deductions that are part of your budget. So go in there deeper and take a look at where the other money is going. It is a very good time, since you're doing it, and I know you're tired, take a day of rest, but then dig back in there, and where else are you spending your money? Now, if you spend using some form of plastic, which of course you pay off in full every month, to track your expenses, go back in and see how much you're spending in different categories. It's a real wake-up call to some people.
Well, what areas do you look at first?
Well, I'll tell you this one. First of all, I do need you to think about goals and kind of see where things are at. So simultaneously, you want to say, where do I have a hole, meaning that I'm spending too much money and digging myself into one? And then where do I really want to be? Because goals, as we all know, it kind of is a way to trick your mind into getting motivated, and it should help you get motivated. But you want to look at what's been bothering you. Is it groceries? Is it your mortgage? Is it transportation? What is really eating at you?
Well, I'll tell you one thing that's eating at me. There are the obvious bits, you know, eating out and entertainment and clothing can be problematic. But more and more, I'm noticing that my money is going to nearly invisible things like data storage and domain names and automated payments for online subscriptions. How do you get a handle on that stuff?
Yeah, you know, things have changed quite a bit since I first started in this business a long time ago. But I still would love for you to name those things and put a price tag on it so you at least know how much money is going as a group into that space, but also if there's anything that you're paying for that you shouldn't be.
What do you find people lose track of the most?
The day-to-day is so expensive, and you find yourself at the end of the month saying, how much did I spend on this? How much? And, you know, groceries to monthly subscriptions to other fees. Every day money is coming out of us. And because it's usually we use plastic, it's become this very amorphous thing. So it's good to take a tally every day. And I always recommend people to do the thing, the diet thing, which is where you really literally write down every dollar you spend. And the simple act of writing it down makes you more cognizant of what you're doing. And it actually, studies show, reduce how much you spend.
Well, do you do a spring budget cleaning yourself, Carmen? And what's the most memorable budget change that you've made after one of these fiscal dustings?
I just did a big one. And you know the biggest part was? It was waste. Groceries. So my schedule can be very sporadic. And it's just, you know, it's myself and my daughter. But man, I really like having fresh produce and fresh meat. The problem is that if the schedule changes and the plans change, things go to waste. And I just hate that. Also, I noticed that that's really expensive. There was a study this year that found that 40% of the money that we spend on groceries actually ends up going into the garbage as waste. So I took that to heart and said, okay, this has got to stop, because not only is it financially irresponsible, but I think, of course, socially and culturally, it's a little irresponsible. So I made a plan every week before I get any groceries. I set out and look at, okay, where am I going to be? What meals do we need? And what do we really, really need? And so I try to do that. And it's, so far, I've cut at least a third.
And just in the last 30 seconds, one big tip that you have for our listeners about maintaining their budget through the seasons?
You know what? Kind of automate it as much as you can. For example, if you don't want to get those statements on paper, if you want to be able to pay as many things as you can automated, they'll mean fewer late fees. And I've done this as well. Connect it with a charge card or with a debit card so your bills get paid, and so that you know and you can track where everything's going.
Carmen Wong-Ulrich is a personal finance journalist and author of The Real Cost of Living. And it's always a joy to talk with you, Carmen. Thanks.
Thank you so much, Barbara.
Oh, if only you could automate your personal finance spring cleaning. How great would that be? But it's just not that simple, right? Because it means different things to different people.
Part of my financial spring cleaning routine is about paying down debt. That's a big thing because even though, yeah, I made less money last year, this year I'm on a better track, so I'll be able to do that, and I definitely have that budgeted in. And just keeping better track of where my money goes. I don't think I was always very good at that. And now as I hit middle age, I think it's definitely an appropriate time to sort of, you know, keep more track of where the money's going and be a little more cautious.
My plans for spring cleaning were I decided to go through my closet and basically try on everything that was still hanging up. And I ended up getting rid of a garbage bag full of clothes to I donated it to the local children's foundation. Just, you know, another way that I feel like cleaning up my life a little and doing something good.
That was Megan Ortiz from Los Angeles and Jessica Newport from Washington, D.C. If you've been spring cleaning your closet along with us this hour and have decided to give some of your clothes to charity, do yourself a favor and check the label first. If it says Made in the USA, you might consider a consignment store. That label could mean your cast-offs are worth some real money. A new survey shows 80% of shoppers would pay more for American-made goods, but be careful. What you think is a homegrown product might not be. Consumer Reports recently looked into the questionable origins of some of the products labeled Made in the USA. Shopping expert Todd Marks is a senior project editor with Consumer Reports, and he joins us now. Todd, welcome to the show.
My pleasure to be here with you today.
So what reasons does this 80% of the country give for why they prefer to buy American-made products?
Their primary reason for wanting to buy American-made goods, even more so than creating jobs and keeping the economy chugging along, was because there's a very strong perception that American companies treat their workers better and that there's more of a sense of a social conscience, giving back to the community, you know, less likely to employ questionable practices such as child labor. Yeah, it's goes beyond the obvious.
Are people willing to put their money where their mouths are, though? Are they also okay with paying more for products made in
America? Yeah, absolutely. That survey that Consumer Reports National Research Center didn't just ask, you know, do you prefer to buy American, but would you be willing to pay more? And in fact, 60% of all the respondents indicate that they'd buy American-made clothes and appliances even if they cost 10% more than the imported version.
Well, that's what people say, but what do the numbers show? Do people choose homegrown goods over exports even when they do cost more?
Well, I think there's an inclination that people would. The problem is, in many instances, is that there just aren't that many American-made goods being made in certain categories, so the options aren't there. It's an impediment to consumers to want to support our economy more. And you look at areas like electronics, personal electronics in particular, and you look at things like clothing. Clothing is an industry that's probably unlikely to come back to America anytime soon.
What does the label Made in America really mean, though? What federal requirements have to be met to permit a company to label something made in the USA?
Well, there are a gaggle of federal agencies that oversee labeling, but Made in the USA claims is the purview of the Federal Trade Commission, which looks for deceptive or misleading advertising. And when you see a label on a product that says Made in the USA, you can be assured that that product is either all or virtually all made here. It's the gold standard of all label claims. There's no ambiguity. But that's what they call an unqualified claim. There are what they call qualified claims that kind of suggest like what Apple does. They're very big into this. For example, their new iPad mini says, designed by Apple in California but assembled in China. And that's kind of sending a mixed message. So there is a lot of ambiguity. Yes, American brain power is theoretically behind this, but the actual fabrication of the item was done overseas. And those are things that people have a hard time deciphering.
There is so much chicanery going on, too, with these labels. I've seen labels that say made in, and then there's an American flag, for instance. Is something like that an outright violation, or, you know, is it legal but just misleading?
No, it's not. As a matter of fact, the use of things like American flags, maps of the lower 48 states, the Statue of Liberty, an eagle in flight, all these patriotic symbols we find are used willy-nilly on a lot of companies that make goods far from our shores. Same thing with the use of words. True American quality, American heritage, you know, those kind of things. The use of these words and symbols may not mean anything because the Federal Trade Commission has really found, what they say is that we look at everything on a case-by-case basis to see what the overall message is. And symbols and words in and of themselves aren't enough to constitute a violation, as long as somewhere in a conspicuous manner is the actual story. For example, you can use the flag as long as you see somewhere in a prominent place, the item says, say, Made in Vietnam. But a lot of people don't go beyond the symbols or the words, so they jump to conclusions. And the fact of the matter is, companies can do that and they can get away with it. And unless you're a real eagle-eyed consumer, in the truest sense of the word, you may not even notice. Sadly, but the reality is, for all the talk, the FTC has rarely brought any actions against companies who have been maybe stretching the truth.
So bottom line, if consumers are serious about buying American-made goods, what should they do to be sure?
Look for the words Made in the USA, because those, as I mentioned earlier, are unqualified claims that are the gold standard. If you're looking to find out where a product was made, not where it was just necessarily designed, thought up, you know, or conjured up, where it was actually put together with labor, look for those words because they don't lie.
Todd Marks is a shopping expert and senior project editor with Consumer Reports. Thanks for taking the time to talk with me today.
Anytime. My pleasure. Thanks so much, Barbara.
This weekend, the whole country is focused on the ongoing developments in the Boston bombing story. But for the victims of the violence and for their family members, the focus is on grieving and also the road to recovery. After tragedies like these, homegrown charities usually pop up immediately to help victims. And with emotions running high, people flock to give. But how do you decide which charities are reputable and which are scams? Ken Berger is president and CEO of Charity Navigator. That's a website which ranks philanthropic organizations, and he joins us now. Welcome, Ken.
Thanks.
What micro-charities are you seeing for victims of the bombing in Boston and now this explosion in Texas?
We're seeing a variety of charities popping up, none of them that have any track record that we know of. So there's, for example, there's a group in Boston called TUG that's raising funds. And, of course, in the case of Boston, as was the case in New Jersey after Hurricane Sandy, the governor has organized a fund, just as they did in New Jersey.
And do you have a sense of how freely people are giving?
People are giving a lot. Millions of dollars have already been raised. So the outpouring is amazing, as it often is the case.
Would you have any tips for people then listening to help them choose how to give to best help people and communities in a situation like this, and how to choose which charity to invest in?
A lot of it has to do with risk and expectations. And the faster you want to see the money move, if that's your expectation, the higher your risk. If you're willing to wait a while, you lower your risk substantially. But the concern is that, you know, victims and families need support right away. And so it's a trade-off. So there's no easy answer. Our general recommendation is to go slow, because then you know for certain it's a reputable organization with a track record, or even a new organization like one organized by the governor and the mayor that has the gravitas that eventually the money will get there. That's really the key. The faster you go, the higher the likelihood you're going to get ripped off.
Well, what solutions are people proposing to some of the less efficient ways that these charities work?
I think one of the most interesting ones that we've heard of recently is a group of about 50 families that have been victims, or the families of victims, of tragedies including September 11th, Sandy, as well as Newtown tragedy, and others have come together, and their solution is they're wanting to create a new charity called the National Compassion Funds. And this will guarantee that all the money will go to victims. It will go relatively quickly to the victims. So it's a very interesting model, because it's really getting to the problem that a lot of these charities face, which is they don't always really have their ear to the ground when it comes to the victims and the people that they serve. And this is a way for those people themselves to really make sure that the charity strikes that balance between vetting and accountability, while at the same time moving with speed to get people what they need.
Well, what about giving to these homegrown charities, people who have a family member or a friend who was a victim? They start charities on Kickstarter and those kinds of platforms.
You know, the general rule of thumb there is some of them are wonderful and some of them are terrible. And so if you live in the local area and you can eyeball the organization yourself, then by all means, go for those local homegrown organizations if you really feel they're going to do some good work right away. But if you're in another state and you have to make an assessment from a distance, you run a risk that the charities are not that well vetted, that they could be a scam.
You know, you've tracked this charitable giving for a long time. What patterns do you notice when it comes to people opening up their hearts and wallets? For instance, does a bombing or a shooting solicit a different response from, say, a natural disaster?
I think that they're very similar in a lot of ways. The speed with which it happens, within the first few days, there's an explosive outpouring. And as long as it's in the public consciousness, there continues to be a real surge in giving. And then after it falls off the radar of the media, frankly, that often is where you see a steep decline. And then the challenge becomes, how much money are we going to use for the immediate, and how much are we going to use for the longer term? And that's always a difficult decision for the charities. I think that donors generally expect that the money should be used very quickly, and donors' expectations are often not met.
Well, how about the flip side of this process? What advice do you have for people who do have the urge to set up a charity for victims of a tragedy?
You know, we have more charities in the United States than anywhere else in the world. The best first step is to look around and to see if there are others involved, or organizations that have a track record that are going to be involved, or, you know, if the governor and the mayor are going to get involved, to try to hook your efforts up to those efforts rather than starting something from whole cloth. You can get some traction there. You can get some additional funds there. You can get the expertise that you otherwise might not have.
Ken Berger is president and CEO of Charity Navigator. Thanks for this.
My pleasure.
That'll do it for Marketplace Money for this week. Next time, furloughs. Listen to what Acting Undersecretary of Defense Jessica Wright said this week.
The effects of sequestration and the continuing resolution on our military personnel will be devastating, but on our civilians, it will be catastrophic.
We'll be checking in on those of you who've been affected by the furloughs and how you're handling it. And as we said at the top of the show, we'd like to hear from you. If furloughs are putting your family under pressure, please let us know. And you can also ask us questions about any aspect of personal finance at marketplacemoney.org or on our Facebook page and on Twitter at Radio Piggy Bank. Tell us your story, and you might be our next guest on the show. Marketplace Money is produced by Patty Hirsch with Devin Maverick Robbins, Lindsay Foster Thomas, and Daryl Paranava. Bill Lance is our engineer. Our theme music was composed by Mark Governor. The executive producer of the program is Deborah Clark. The Marketplace General Manager is J.J. Yore. I'm Barbara Bogave. Have a great weekend, everybody.
There's a lot packed into an hour of Marketplace Money. Check it out again on our website at marketplace.org or take the show with you. Download the show by clicking on the subscribe to podcast link and never miss an episode again.
This is APM.